Morning, everybody. Well, we had a rollicking good time last week, didn't we? Looking at models. Hopefully it'll be a little more tame this week. Maybe. I based this talk on three books, and I was going to brag to you that one of them is used books, and you can run right over there and pick it up. And Colleen tells me it's no longer in print. Is it no longer in print, or we can probably find it on Amazon or somewhere? But the Hughes book is Creation as Science. Is it coming back? Do you know, or is it dead forever? Okay. Creation as Science.
What's the date on
publication? 06. Yeah, it's not that old. And then this is a book that Warren and Nancy, who had car problems this morning and couldn't make it, gave me. I stole it from them, actually. Yes. God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God, John Lennox. This is outstanding. If there was one book you wanted to read and get a great education in apologetics, along with Hughes stuff, this is one. And then this is one Mark Perez gave me, A Case Against Accident and Self-Organization. A little more technical, but loads of fun on a Friday night. Okay. Seriously. Okay, we're going to look... Today we're going to look at theistic creation models versus naturalistic creation models. And it's sort of general. It's not just RTB's model. It's theistic models in general, although I'm always referring to the God of the Bible and not just God of any religion. Okay? So last week, who remembers what a model is?
A simplified representation of a system or phenomenon.
Wow.
No. He has your notes.
Anybody else want a number, not a number, or I don't say fast?
Okay. Very good. So, very quickly, somebody give me a couple of examples of a model.
Descriptive.
Okay, there was descriptive model, yeah, but a particular thing.
Weather.
A map.
Good. What's a map a model of?
An area or of the world, anything.
Good. What's this book a model of? Sounds like something John would say. It's a model of whatever the guy is trying to convey to us. For example, okay. A model is a simplified description of a system or a phenomenon. In science, we use models all the time. There's a naturalistic model. There's a creation model. And one of the ways that models works is using something called abductive logic. You know about inductive, you know about deductive. This is a word that's not used so much. But this is actually the type of logic that is used the most often in our normal day-to-day life. It's basically just taking two things, comparing them, and deciding which one is the best choice. Or three things, or four things, reasoning from the best explanation. You want to decide which job to take? You have two or three job offers? You use abductive logic to decide which one to take. You weigh all the possibilities, you find out which one works the best for you, and you make that choice. In day-to-day life, this is the way we think. Can anybody else think of a common sense, common day-to-day abductive logic choice? What's that? Sure. Sure. What to eat. Which job to take. All of us have political viewpoints which we believe are based on reasoning from the best explanation, although people have very different outcomes what they believe. But the way that we think about it is this kind of thinking. This is how models work in science. When Newton had his laws of motion and Einstein came along with general relativity, for a moment, there were two models. Newton described things in this manner, Einstein described things in this manner, and they were put to the test, and they decided which one won out. And Newton still works, but Einstein describes it much more specifically. So That's how science makes decisions. Models come and go. The best one, the one that holds up, the one that can make predictions, the one that is can be falsifiable often, although all scientific theories are not falsifiable, the one that carries the most weight, the one that reflects reality the best, is the one usually that goes on. Now, what we're going to do is compare these two models, taking specific points and saying which model best describes this phenomenon. Okay? Another good model from science is the one that Hughes talked about, the origin of the moon. The new idea is that a Mars-sized collider collided with the moon at a low speed, at a high angle. Earth-sized collider, yes. And the explosion, the resulting explosion, created what's it now, the Earth and the moon. And what would a good prediction be if that theory just came along and you wanted to test that theory? What is a potential way that that could be tested?
You find some marshes somewhere.
Ellen? Helen? So, similarity in the material. That's right. So that's a way to test that model. Okay?
How recent is that?
Is that model?
Yeah.
I think Hugh's been talking about it for about 7 or 8 years. Do you know, Rich? Or
it's
Mark, do you know?
The trips to the moon, so it started in...
Like the 70s then?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been confirmed with computer models for the last few years. The computer models determined that's the only acceptable answer.
But what they found, Ross, was the moon rocks were lighter than expected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, the part that was blasted away, you would expect to be the lighter material, coalesced into the moon. So then the theory started forming.
Gaining weight.
Yeah.
I found that not in the Genesis, how the moon was created. He says he created the sun and the moon. He didn't say there was a big rock that blasted a bunch of stuff from the earth and created the moon. They didn't say that in Genesis. Says that.
Well, there's 5 billion details that aren't in Genesis.
Do you remember Hugh, what his answer to that question was the last time you asked a question like that? Well, I thank God that the Bible is not a science book,
because
I wouldn't be able to
church
on Sunday morning.
That's right.
No.
That's a good question.
Okay, let's look at some very, very broad general definitions of the two models. Naturalism. The natural world is all that exists. All of reality can be explained by natural law. That's the model. That's the naturalistic model that we're going to be looking at. Biblical creation model. The God of the Bible exists, is responsible for all of creation. He established all physical laws and intervenes from time to time at his discretion. Al?
What are the physical laws they're talking about here?
Physics. Yeah, the laws of physics.
Everything. So they knew about it then. Whoever wrote the Bible knew that E equals M.
That's not what that says.
I know it says all physical laws.
No, it says he's responsible for all physical laws.
Including ones we haven't discovered yet.
Right. John?
Physical laws are merely a term that is used to express features of the universe and how they're observed to behave. And so another way to phrase it is he established all the characteristics of the universe in the way it behaves.
That's right.
And the scientists have embodied some of the general principles that they've observed in what they call physical laws, and therefore they call the law, because it's something they find is always true in all their observations.
Well, I know that what you're saying is true about that statement, because I wrote that statement. Okay, so now... we've got the two models. Let's go at it. All right. We're going to start with the one that is probably the most interesting. And if we spend the rest of the class talking about this one thing, I wouldn't be surprised. And we'll finish some other time. But let's talk about the origin of life. Okay. Before we get to the specifics, I want to sort of go through something that I've been thinking about that I think applies to this. I want to talk about, think about anything that you can think of that has been designed by humans, by animals. How many people have made something as a hobby, as a job? What have you, just shout out things that you've created, that you've made, that you've produced.
Art.
Bikini. What's that?
Three children.
Good.
Report.
Lee?
A transmitter. I'm an amateur radio.
Excellent. A radio transmitter that's highly technical. Is anybody, how many people have?
Ceramics.
Ceramics. Helen?
Cookies.
Cookies. How many people have written a computer program? Okay, that qualifies.
Built
a building. Excellent. Ted, you had your hand up?
Motorcycle parts.
Okay.
I was building an airplane.
Good. Okay. What I'm going to do is talk about building a car. And you will find similarities in this description to whatever it is that you have built. What's the very first thing that you have to do when you build something? You have to think of it. The idea has to come to you. And often with man-made things, it's very seldom that we think of something truly, truly original. It's almost always based on other stuff that people have done, and it's a small step forward in the evolution. Cars were based on horseless carriages and on motorcycles, and you know, the idea of putting a motor on something with four wheels predated the car a long time before. So in human terms, it usually is a slow progression from its ideas are built one on the other. It's rarely a phenomenal change, but sometimes it is. Next step. And these steps are very fluid, and if you think there are steps I've missed, tell me. Now you got to conceive of the details. What does the car need? Well, it's got to go, so it probably needs to have wheels. You could build a track, or you got to be able to steer it, so there has to be some kind of steering mechanism. What else? It's got to stop, so you have to somehow be able to grab a hold of the wheel when you want to stop it.
Speed.
What's that?
Control the speed.
That's right. It's not either on or off. It's not like 0 or 80 all the time.
You need an engine.
You need an engine. What kind of engine is it going to be? And in a modern car, the choices are myriad. Sound system, navigation system, pollution control system. There's computers in the cars now that control all of this stuff. So the details, thousands of details. Then you got to consider the details and how they relate to each other. Let's say you want to put all this stuff in your car. You want to put a coffee maker, you know, and a TV, and you know, a swimming pool in the trunk, and all of these cool things.
16 models.
That's right. All these cool things that you want to put in the car, but then you realize, well, you know what? It's only 22 feet long and 8 feet wide, and it won't fit, and it would make it really heavy, and I'd probably get distracted and crash into somebody. So there's considerations of what we can include practically and what we can't, right? So you're tracking so far? Anything we design sort of has these steps. So we choose the appropriate details, the ones we want to include. Then we have to figure out the structure. What's it going to look like? Is it going to look like the Batmobile? Is it going to look like, you know, Bugs Bunny car with a big tall thing, you know, with the windshield hanging out? Or are you going to design it so it's stylish and looks nice? Or is it going to be functional? Collect and stage the raw materials, many of which themselves have already been designed. If you went to an automobile factory and looked at every part that goes onto the assembly line, how many of those parts were already made to size, made of a certain material, pre-programmed in some way? Acquire experience in construction. You got to know how to put it together and have the skills to be able to do it, right? Have all the necessary tools on hand. You have to be able to, don't forget the hammer. Start construction, the order and techniques used, oh boy, did I misspell that. Canone from experience. Wow, that's a model of a bad PowerPoint. Okay. Now, here's one that's not, doesn't exist in everything we create, but input information needed, program. If a computer has a car, if a car has a computer, that computer has to be programmed to do the things that it's going to do. You don't just build the microchip and it automatically does it. It has to be given instructions on, you know, push this when the brake is pushed and push this when the accelerator is pushed and turn to the left when the wheel goes left. Those are not things it just does. Those are all programmed into it by a computer program which is fed into the ROM memory in the car. Everybody understand? Everybody following so far? Ensure proper construction and repair any mistakes, sort of a quality control. Once you've built it, does it start? Does it steer? Does it do the things that it's supposed to? Is the paint peeling off? Ensure that the final product is within quality standards and functions well. Okay? Now, where I'm going with this, you might have already guessed, is that this is characteristics of things that are designed that we, even a spider web, we don't make a spider web. An animal makes a spider web, but it still has characteristics of design. Now, let me get a little more philosophical with some of these characteristics. And I lost my note here. There it is. Here's the statement I want to make, and here's where I want you to go with this. Only things that are designed, okay, have high functional information content. In other words, name some things that have information in them.
DNA.
Okay. Your computer?
Computer.
Your cell phone?
Everything.
Your car? We just talked about a car. What are some other things? So many things have computer chips. A watch?
Books.
Anything that's digital? A book? Excellent. Excellent. It's not all electronic information. Skywriting?
Anything with cells in it?
Anything with cells in it? That's very good. Dick?
Pin in my pocket. The information's up there.
That's right. Very good. Okay. Here's a question. Can you think of any example of something that has a high information content that wasn't designed?
God.
Good. That's about it. Now, what else do you need when you have, let's say you've developed this alphabet. If you go... I remember reading this years ago. There were some tapes they found at JPL that had pictures of the moon from one of the first Apollo trips, and they couldn't find a machine that could read, that could look at the photos. And some guy had one of these ancient machines literally in his garage, and they had to figure out how to fix it before they could look at the photos. And the photos were amazing. They finally released them. But what's the point of the information was on the tape. It was like a big, giant, like VHS, only bigger kind of thing. Does the information that was on that drive, on that tape, have any functional use if you can't read it? You can look at the tape, you can't see anything. So information isn't enough. You've got to have information processing. You've got to be able to translate it. If, as I'm talking right now, my brain is putting my thoughts into words. I'm saying the words. The words are the information. You're, if you're not asleep, are processing the words and hopefully understanding what I'm saying. So there's a process on each end. You have to turn it into language. Then you have to decode it in your own way that you understand it. Everything that uses information has that at both ends. That tape with the pictures from the moon, it was recorded onto that tape by a machine that coded it into the language. And then another machine, or maybe the same machine, decoded it in pictures that we can understand. So everything has that code, information, decode process. Okay? So Many things that we design have that process in it. It's not just the language. It's the coding and the decoding. Okay. High complexity. Does anybody know what the definition of complexity is? It's a word that we sort of throw around and we kind of understand what it means. There's a really easy definition, and I just learned this while I was studying this. What is it?
A lot of components
to it. That's close. In information technology, the definition of complexity is how many instructions, how many pieces of information does it take to create something. Remember last week I pulled out a set of building plans. Building plans are a model of a house or whatever you're building. Think about the average, just pick a house. How many pieces of information? Each piece of information can specify a particular detail in the house. But how much information does it take to specify all the details, every single one in the house? A lot. Okay, so just think about in terms of number of instructions. Whenever you see the word complex, how many instructions does it take to make that? And this is interesting because if you look in the literature for origin of life, the naturalist guys love to confuse order and complexity, and they're not the same. Complex things require a lot of instructions. Highly complex things require a lot of instructions to make them. So everybody understand that? Okay. So
they're usually orderly, right?
Well, it depends on what you mean by order. Order simply means repetitive. So if I had a book that had the number 459 repeated 1,000 times, okay? I open the first page, and the first page says 459, 459, 459, 459, 459, all the way to the end of the book. Okay? Is that orderly?
No.
Yes. It's highly ordered. Yes, you're right. How many pieces of information would it take to produce that? Almost none. All you have to do is say 459, repeat 10,000 times. There's four instructions or whatever it is. So it's a very low information content. You see the difference?
No, I'm thinking, that doesn't really matter. Because you get to a point where you have to.
Order and complexity are often opposites, and I didn't understand that distinction till recently. Order is repetitive. Complexity is number of instructions, which is by nature not repetitive, because the wall's got to be this color and the clock has that kind of hand on it and it's that color and the light has to be this size and filled with this kind of gas and how many thousands of details are there to specify something. That's not orderly, that's complex.
Right, so kind of like the DNA, you know, it's very repetitive, but once in a while you get, you know, something different.
It's actually not highly repetitive.
Really?
No. But it is complex.
But different species.
Okay. What I want to do is use this model that I just did a model. Oh, there's one more detail. Okay, we did high complexity, high specificity in construction, and here's what I mean by that. We'll go back to the car model. If you're building the piston for the car, you can't just throw together a hunk of metal. It has to be very precisely made as to the material, the shape, the size. So there's a high specificity in how it's made. Okay? Now, all things that aren't designed aren't highly specific in their construction. If you dig a hole in the ground, you know, a 2-foot hole is a hole. A 3-foot deep hole is a hole. If it's 4 feet wide, it doesn't matter. It's still a hole in the ground. Well, it's a designed hole, but it's very nonspecific. You know, think of a mouse trap. If the spring was half as strong as it is, or the base was bigger, or the arm was made out of one metal kind of versus another. That's sort of a medium specificity object. You can imagine changing many of the parts in many ways and it still works like a mousetrap. Does that make sense? Another good example is a fire pit. You go up to the mountains and you see this ring of rocks on the ground and you say, okay, that's where the fire goes, right? Well, one of the rocks can be kicked over, or somebody could have put a log there. Could there be 17 rocks or 5 rocks, or they're not really in a circle? That was designed. Somebody did it on purpose, but it's not very highly specific. But many things that are designed are highly specific. Everybody understand that distinction? Okay. Now, here's what I want to do. When it comes to origin of life, this is my model that I made up, and I want to test this against things in the biological world. Which, if we look at DNA, using this model, does it look designed, or does it look like it came about by natural processes? Okay. Leave it to Al. The origin of life is the biggest discontinuity other than the origin of the universe in the natural world. The moment before there was no life, the world was full of very low complexity. Everybody understand now that term? The moment life occurred, all of a sudden there's the most complex machine we've ever experienced. Okay? Now, remember the process of the one, this one with the car, the design. What we are expected to believe is that the individual cell, which the analogy I heard was that if you could blow an individual cell up to being 20 miles wide, you would be able to see each atom and molecule as they moved around and performed the functions that they did. So it would be like a 20 mile on a side factory. That's the level of complexity in a single cell organism. Okay? And there's enough information in that single cell in the DNA, and we talked about information, approximately the same as in about a 300 page book. About 1,500,000. Yes, John. I see the cynic look.
I think that's way underestimated. Yeah. For example, you take simple amino acid.
You know what that was? I remember where I got that. That was the number from the simplest cell they think they can make that only has like 400 genes. Yeah.
Not anything that's living at this moment.
Right.
Or the cell.
Right.
But let's not even get that concept. The amino acids change. They vary from about under 100 to over 1,000.
Right.
Let's say you take a simple chain of 200 amino acids. We're not talking life. We're just talking one simple, stupid protein. To get that one protein, a relatively simple one, by the way, of only 200 amino acids, by random chance, mathematically, statistically, if you assume, now note the figure, if you assume 1 trillion chemical interactions per second of every atom in the universe, every atom in the universe is not in some pool of water, has 1 trillion chemical interactions producing a different result each time. It would take you a 100 billion, B as in boy, 100 billion times 30 billion years to just get that first little simple protein.
That's right.
A cell has about 2,000.
Now, all of those arguments are valid, but I'm trying to make a slightly different argument. What I'm trying to say is that if you have a naturalistic model that says all life came about by some random process, we have a theistic model that says God created life, we have the ordinary day-to-day experience of what things that are designed look like? What characteristics, things that are designed, look like? Which one does biology look like? Which one does the DNA look like?
Since life arose almost instantaneously, once it could arise after the heavy bombardment, instantly arose, does it have to be a creator or design? Because if it was natural, for example, that one simple protein would take 100 billion years.
That's right.
30 billion years.
But does the cell look like it's designed? Does it have the characteristics that we've identified as things that are designed? Al, does it have the characteristics of things that we've identified as being designed?
Suppose it came from outer space and it was designed somewhere
designed
else.
There.
Well, okay, but use Al, put on your abductive logic hat and tell me which is the most likely explanation, given the facts of science as they are right now, not with any bias. Just look at the facts.
Yeah.
Wait. Based on the facts, what's the most likely explanation for
the
cell?
Of course, would be like what? We have a grand designer, right?
Thank you. Okay. Great. Y'all heard it. But Al, when we use abductive logic, we're not looking for proof. We're looking for the best explanation.
Yeah, okay.
And that's how theories advance.
But you can do this. If I go to
we're not going to get proof.
I was building an airplane. You would come up and say, who built that airplane? Said Al built that airplane. You know, but you're saying that. Well, you said you can.
Gosh, he's speechless. I got him.
You said, "Well, go talk to Al." And I said, "Yeah, I built it up. There's proof." You tell me that. How can you prove that a grand designer called God made that first? Not the first atom, even. How about the particle?
You're not going to get proof. If that's what you're waiting for, you're not going to get it. What's the best explanation, given the facts, as they are right now?
That's the best and the easiest, of course.
Thank you. Okay. All right. End of story. Yes.
But it's right, not right.
Christy.
The same proof. I mean, it's the same level. Someone asked him and said, yeah, I knew it.
Oh, cool.
That's right. What if you're lying about you did it? Okay. Yes. Brother.
You don't have to know who built it to know that it exists.
Well, I know that it
exists.
Right.
You find a plane crashed into the hillside.
That's correct.
I don't know who built it. It exists.
And it's but dead. Yes, that's right. Okay.
If it crashed, it did build.
Yeah.
That's right. What I'm trying to say is that if it has these design characteristics, the high information content, the high specificity in the parts, and high complexity, all of our experience is that thing is designed. Why would we think differently about the cell? Now, is that a rational deduction?
Yes.
Is it a scientific deduction?
Yes.
Yes, clearly it is. Is it a biased deduction?
Yes.
Well, we can have some biases, yes. but we're not adding anything to the equation. We're just looking at the facts and saying, you know what? Looks a lot like stuff we build. Okay. Now, what's that?
I've got to say the whole idea of abductive logic is subject to bias because it's subject to the individual experience.
Sure it is. Sure it is. Yeah, our worldview is going to play into that. All we can do is look for lower level of bias versus higher level of bias. We'll never get to where we have no bias. But I think to say that I believe the cell is designed because it looks more like stuff we know is designed than it looks like stuff that we know isn't designed is a fairly unbiased statement. Okay. Would you agree with that, Tim?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. So, what is the materialist going to say about the origin of life? Despite present appearances, life came into existence as a random event and is completely explainable by natural law. Okay.
Now, they've actually gotten to the point where now it's past the fermium. Unless it comes someplace else.
Yeah, but that just pushes it. If physical laws are the same from one place to another, that just pushes the origin off to another planet somewhere.
Yep, same problem with
that. That's right. Okay. Now, here's...
That's the fact that, you know, where did this come from? Where did this come from? I mean, you trace it all the way back. It has to start.
Right. Now, here's the other thing, the other point that I want to make. Remember, we were talking about this stage, the design characteristics, building a car. Everything that we know of that's designed, you got to think it up, you got to build it, all of those steps that we talked about. Now, what's the naturalist saying about the origin of life? He's saying, this is all bogus. We don't need any of these steps. It just came about. Is there anything that's designed that didn't go through some sort of semblance of these steps? I can't think of a single one. So why, under any circumstances, would we think that an individual cell came about by natural processes?
And they call that scientific.
And they call that scientific. Thank you. Very good. This is one of the points I want to make. I was going to do it at the end, but I'm going to say it now because what you're saying is really true. The evidence is on our side. The evidence has been on our side for a long time. The evidence is more and more overwhelmingly on our side. And we're scared to death to go out there and get it out there. Hal?
Getting back to the cell, I believe in evolution, and
we know that
the cell has no evolution, has no plan. It doesn't plan for that.
That's why this is impossible to have. That's exactly my point. It can't possibly have come about without planning.
That little tiny cell did not know that it was going to grow into humans or mastodons or dinosaurs. It didn't know that. It just started. I don't know what started. It might have been God. There's no proof of that, but it could have been. But the whole thing is, everything that we know of is built on experience that we get from the previous one. You don't make a car.
Exactly. That's right. And this is based on our experience. That's my point.
But that has no plan. That cell.
That's why it's impossible for it to have happened. Thank you. Yes.
Well, I mean, the proof of what they've experimented with the bacteria experiment, you know, if you take the simplest life form with tiny generations length, and say, let's go 20,000 generations and watch the process that Al says exists operate. It didn't operate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They got no new improved complexity.
They got stasis.
Out of watching a organism relate to a change in its environmental.
Or
they got nothing. With the simplest life form to demonstrate the principle.
The deep rays.
Right. Jim?
Michael Behe, in his book, Darwin's Black Box, explained that, like the simplest cell you were talking about, it can't have evolved bit by Darwinian explanation, because it's so complex. If you take out one little thing, none of it works.
It's irreducibly complex. That's the term he invented. Dave?
Yeah, and then I've talked about in the past, obviously, that all of our real-time tests on species shows that when you try and change a species from its norm, it gets weaker and it goes extinct. Life does not like to change. You cannot change. You can make it bigger, you can make it smaller, and even making those changes, it becomes weaker. You know, and what we've done to dogs,
that's a great example.
50,000 years prove that obviously life likes to stay the way it is. It does not like to change away from it is. You know, it does like it.
That's right. So, you know, this is an interesting point. Hugh talks about microevolution, about a species being able to adapt to its environment. You know what? That's one of the qualities that God gave species so that we don't die out every time some little thing changes. And that is part of the design. John?
In a Scopes monkey trial, the evolutionists themselves said, if you could show that the cell is a machine, the evolutionists would lose. Our argument at the time we thought it was just a thing of protoplasm, like jelly, with electricity in it.
Machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they thought it was just jelly.
Yeah.
Protoplasm with electricity running through.
Yeah.
Today, we now know each cell has thousands of intricate machines and thousands of machines. They've lost their arguments. The machines are only design. And design only comes from quality.
It's all your thinking.
Yeah, so my bottom line is, and I want to go on to the next one. We've looked at the characteristics of design. Everything that we design as human beings has some or all of those characteristics. Nothing that we know isn't designed has a lot of those characteristics. So what the naturalist is expecting us to believe is the most single complex entity that exists, a biological cell, somehow got past all of those rules, all of those ideas about design, and came into being by itself with no thought, with no purpose. It's more complex than anything we've designed. More moving parts, more information content, more specificity in design. That's what you can say to a naturalist, okay?
And the processing.
That's right. And the information processing. Yeah, you have to have that whole input-output modem thing to understand the information. Ted?
I was going to say, if you look at the scale of the difference between a life process and a simple natural process, you're not talking about 10 times more or 100 times more. You're talking about 10 to the 40th power more. You know, they're not even, it would be like one black dot and you're trying to look at it from 2 miles away versus everything else in your sight. The natural process is the black dot. Everything else in your sight is the light.
Right. Here's how, in my opinion, here's how ridiculous the... and I think it is. I think it's a good word to use. The evolutionary paradigm that things started out unbelievably simple and worked their way towards complexity, and that life came into existence all by itself. The next time you read one of those like one or two paragraph things about this is how evolution happened, you know, the warm pond and amino acids turn into proteins and then there's this self-replicator, here's how you think about it. Okay, I'm going to tell you how ridiculous it is, because relate it to building a car. Okay, I'm going to tell you a story about how a car was built. All right, once upon a time there was this warm pond that had a lot of metal solution in it, okay? And there was this lightning bolt that came down, and somehow it formed an engine block, okay? And then there was this sludge that came out of this hole in the ground, and there were some these particular things that happened, and it turned into four tires, okay? Then something else happened, and the tires, you know, maybe it was an avalanche that had exactly the right inertia, and it was spinning as it fell down, and it took the lug nuts and tightened them on to the axle. And that's how ridiculous it is. That is exactly how ridiculous it is what they're saying.
Okay. Well, everything is pretty ridiculous when you start thinking about the origin of life, and nobody really knows for sure. Not even 98% of the atheist scientists know for sure.
Al, it looks designed because it was designed. It's really that simple.
You have to prove it.
No, I don't have to prove it. You're going to be the last guy in the room. You're going to be sitting there, and you're going to go, God, you've got to prove it to me.
When I was building my plane, I had to go out of Destin and fly it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't be here.
Al, have you ever seen anything designed that happened by chance?
No.
How do you know?
Okay. All right, let's go on here.
You don't believe in random chance?
Let's take another one.
No, you don't.
Okay, there you go.
The universe has a beginning. All right. What is a creationist account for this? RTB, a theist, would say that God is responsible for this event. Okay? What would a naturalist say about this event?
Big Bang.
Mm. Is God responsible for it?
Well, they had to go to the multiverse because the universe looks so divine.
That's right.
We just have lots of them out there. Of course, they don't explain where the universe happened to come from.
One of the things that you can say about this one, if you're discussing this with someone, is the idea of a creation event The idea that the universe had a beginning was repugnant to scientists of the time for decades. Why? Because they saw that it had theological implications. If the universe was eternal, that's right. If the universe was eternal and it's been around forever, then there's no reason evolution can't explain everything. Origin of life, it just happened because the world's been around for a gazillion years. But as soon as we realized that there was a beginning, many scientists resisted that idea because they didn't like the theological implications. So the Big Bang is actually a very theistic idea. The only reason they accepted it is because the evidence was just so overwhelming for so long that they couldn't say no anymore.
Well, the multiverse has also been shown by theoretical physicists to have a beginning. And anything that has a beginning has to have a reason for it to come into existence.
Well, the main thing to say about the multiverse idea is it's an Easter Bunny story. There's no evidence for it. Somebody made it up. It's a story. It's Santa Claus.
There's
yes.
Not a funny story.
Yeah.
If it is the multiverse, then in this universe, God created it.
Well, there you go. That's easy. Enough.
That's right.
But everything.
Al, stop. No, stop. Al, you've taken half the questions. Okay. All right. So, which, again, here we are. Which is the most likely explanation for the beginning of the universe? No bias, not assuming God, just which is the one that looks the most like it explains what we see? I would say it's a design. Okay. Here's one that's not focused on too much. One of the things that we have in this universe that we have is the creation event occurred in such a way that there is order and consistency in the operation of the universe. Now, we take that for granted. There are such things as natural law. We can live our day-to-day life with some predictability. You know, the sun's going to come up, the earth's going to continue to spin, gravity's going to hold us down. Some things are not predictable, but there is a consistency to it. Now, in any possible universe that you can imagine, is consistency something that would necessarily be there? We don't know. It could be so chaotic that there was no natural law. There was no physical law. My argument is, here we're back to the information argument again. We're back to how much information did it take to produce all of those equations that define natural law, this force being a fraction of this force and it having to be exactly precisely tuned that way, or life can't exist. Okay, so it looks on first blush like this is finely tuned. Like the fact that there is a natural law behind it all, doesn't that imply a lawgiver, somebody who designed it?
The law couldn't have designed itself when it didn't exist yet.
That's right. Now, this is not one of the stronger arguments. It's possible that any possible universe that comes into existence would exist with some kind of natural law consistency in it. We don't know. But from a philosophical standpoint, you can imagine a universe that doesn't have any kind of consistency to it. John?
Multiverse is a metaphysical idea. Not a scientific idea, because you can't prove it. There is zero proof.
You can't even have evidence for it.
And it's outside our space-time continuum.
That's right.
And since you can't prove it, since it's not falsifiable, it is metaphysical, and therefore it's not a scientific hypothesis, and so Al shouldn't even say.
So that's why it's an Easter Bunny story.
Yes.
Ted?
Hugh Ross also uses the gambler's fallacy and the firing squad of 10 expert marksmen all loaded up.
Yeah.
They all point their rifle at you, and bang, they all go off and you're still breathing when it's all over. Well, what happened? Obviously, well, I'm just in the strange place where the wind blew every bullet off, you know, or you'd have to come up with some strange, really weird idea other than those men purpose not to kill you.
That's right.
There has to be purpose and design in you not being dead.
Okay. The next one. Physical life is possible in this universe. About 13 billion years after, more than 13 billion years after the universe came into existence, life came into existence. We all know from what Hugh has taught how unlikely that is with all the fine-tuning characteristics that we that need to be for that to happen. Now, the theistic position would be that this is evidence of a powerful, attentive God. The evidence of this fine-tuning. Now, here's a prediction you can make from that position. We can say that the evidence for this fine-tuning will increase. Okay, what would a naturalist say? This is a random set of features. Their existence cannot be explained except by chance. Possibly the multiverse. Odds seem long now, but will become more probable as we know more. Possibly there's some self-organization principle still to be discovered, and I think we've already discovered him. What would their prediction be? Their prediction would be, as we know more and more, all of this stuff that seems fine-tuned is somehow going to be explainable by natural law. Well, you know what? That's not the direction that the evidence is headed. It's also not, if you just look at the facts as they are right now, it's not what it appears to be. So once again, the fact that physical life is possible in the universe, doesn't it look more like that's a design feature than a random feature? Getting the idea here? The evidence is on our side almost anywhere you look. From a scientific viewpoint.
Carl Sagan thought, what is he, about maybe in the 70s, thought there were three finely tuned characteristics. Water, and I forget what he said.
Yeah.
Now there's about 1,000.
This one's a little different. It has to do with our location. Hughes talked about how this is one of the very few places we are in, one of the very few places in the universe where we can see the whole universe. Now that's not necessarily a prediction from a theistic model. We could say that God could create us and didn't want us to know about the universe, and he put us in a place that's all cloudy and we couldn't see, you know, with a lot of stellar dust and stuff, and we couldn't see anything. But the fact that there's very, very few places in the universe where you can see the whole universe, and we happen to be in one of them, I think is a piece of evidence for design.
It's a piece of evidence for personality.
Yes, it is.
Because it shows
he wants to be
planning to receive the information.
And he doesn't it say something about him wanting to be known?
Yes.
So here's where we can start. This is one of the ones where we can start to say it's not just a God. It's the God that's described in the Bible. Because the God described in the Bible says he wants to be known. And Psalms, what's I don't know the reference. What's the reference? The heavens declare the glory of God? Yeah, that's a perfect example of this. Origins. Some of the least understood... Yeah?
I'm just going to say this would be a good place to put in a plug for why the universe is the way it is, which is being shown at Archimedes Monday night meeting.
Yes, the next one is the
exposure to the fine tuning of the universe comes on Monday night.
The next one is the second Monday in September. The 9th. September 9th in this room, 7 o'clock. Learn about fine tuning. Some of the least understood subjects in science have to do with origins. Okay? It seems to be the areas where we're getting further and further from a naturalistic explanation. And those have to do with we've talked about a couple already, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of humanity, and I like to add the origin of consciousness, because I think that's completely unexplainable by naturalistic terms. If you take at those and look at them as a whole, aren't those the ones that the Bible says that God created? He created the universe. He created life. He created humankind. He gave us a soul. to be able to be conscious with. Now, isn't it interesting that this very same group of things that the Bible says God created are the very same ones that science is getting further and further away from understanding from a naturalistic perspective? So once again, taken as a whole, it looks designed. Scientifically, logically, analyzing it, it looks designed. Exoplanets. What are we learning about? What's a prediction that would be, if the naturalistic model is correct, what would we expect to find when we find planets outside our solar system?
Life.
Well, life, or at least the possibility that they're in some kind of habitable zone where they look like Earth and they would be M-type planets, like they said on Star Trek. Yeah. Now, we're up to like, what, 800 planets, isn't it, Mark?
Yes, more than that. There's a whole bunch more that they haven't quite refined.
And what's the finding? Are they looking more and more like Earth, or are they looking...
They look more and more like gas giants, at least that we can see, and they're very close to the star.
So which way is the evidence headed?
The opposite.
The evidence is headed away from a naturalistic model. Ted?
But there are perhaps two that are worthy of interest.
Tell us about them.
They're within half of an Earth diameter, like within 50% of Earth's diameter. They're in the habitable zone. So at least temperature-wise and gravity-wise, they're appropriate for having liquid water and conditions friendly to life that far. Now, I know there's many other fine-tuning parameters, but that, as far as we're able to determine, those look worthy of interest. Now, on a percentage basis, that's pretty darn good. What's that, maybe half a percent? No, maybe a tenth of a percent of all of the verified planets.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good.
So that's
two planets, I believe, are tidal locked. So that's a major problem.
Dave?
Yeah, but this one here obviously is the problem, because it really should be exoplanet class at its solar system, because finding planets with, you know, similar shape with Earth and maybe having liquid water doesn't explain it. As we talked about, they've been looking for a solar twin for years, and we've studied thousands and thousands of suns, and we've not found one single star that's capable of supporting life any length of time. You know, maybe a star that could support life for a few hundred years, few years. But as far as anything that would sustain life over even a million years, we haven't found a one single star. So our star is right now, as we find out, is the most unique thing. Whereas Houston, we found other stars that are twins, but our sun is totally unique, which means these other planets we found are totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
Just those two planets, and I think others that are close, they're like super rich in carbon and other things. They don't have the right components for life. So chemically, they're...
We know it.
Yeah, they can tell. And so there's too much carbon,
Right.
You can't have life.
But again, Al, as we know it, we have to make decisions based on what we know, not on wishful thinking for the future. Tim?
I think we need to be careful, because we recognize the scientific community themselves has accepted the idea of what is defined scientifically as habitable zone. It simply is liquid water possible.
That's right.
Not just the tiniest little bit of what should be defined as habitable. They haven't looked beyond their own knowledge.
Right. So if we've got the list of all the fine-tuned characteristics of the universe, solar galaxy, solar system, planet, and there's 400 of them, we've crossed two off.
Supposing that you do find a twin bird in all possible parameters, you're still stuck with the first organic...
You're still stuck with the origin of life problem. That's right. That's right.
Where's that going to come from?
Mara?
Know that word. What does that mean?
It means planets outside of our solar system. Yeah. Okay. I've got several more. I'm going to focus on one, because I want to make some closing comments that are really important, and I think. And oh, there it is. One of those. Pain and suffering. Now, this one is not one that you would think would talk about God. How can we... The idea of pain and suffering. It seems like it's a lot. It seems like it's too much. It seems random. How does the idea of pain and suffering, is this one of the things that we have to put on the naturalist column and say, you know, given the evidence for this, seems like there isn't a God. Or is there evidence in the idea of pain and suffering for a creator?
That's
as
a stabilizing mechanism.
It
should be perfect.
Okay.
Pain tells you to get the hell away from it.
That's right. Pain is a protection.
If there were no pain and suffering, most human beings would not turn to God. Because we'd just be so self-sufficient. And I think there's a reason for having pain.
I can speak personally. I think I would be one of the most insufferable, closed-minded people there is. Some people think I am anyway, but if I didn't have the things that have happened to me in my life, it has really tempered. It has really tempered me. Like 2 seconds, Ted, because I want to go.
It is I who wounded and kill. It is I who make alive and heal. God Almighty's quote. I make the lame. I make those who see. I make those the deaf and those who hear. Okay?
That's right. Here's
direct admission and statement of what he does.
Very good. Here's, I think, a very effective argument, and that is that if we were simply animals with just an animal instinct, if we had just evolved from animals, would we even have a sense of right and wrong to be able to say that there's too much pain and suffering in the world? I don't think so. All right, I've got humanity that I don't have time for. But I want to go and make a couple of closing statements. Optimal design, would there be any optimal design without a creator? It would just be trashy half design. Okay, one of the ways that people test science is they say, we're looking at everyday experience. This is the kind of things that happen every day. A naturalist would say, we do not see miracles in the world. Our everyday experience does not include miracles, therefore God does not exist. Okay, but you know what? There's some other things that we don't see in our day-to-day experience. We don't see life from non-life. Why should we believe that? We can't even make the simplest amino acids combine into like three proteins by any random process. Okay, based on our everyday experience, should we believe that somehow life came from non-life? And we're back to the information arguments. We do not see the creation of functional information from natural processes anywhere. Why should we believe that that happened by itself? We do not see creation of highly specified parts or processes from natural processes. Why should we believe that that happened? And then going back to the miracles argument, how many people in this room have had an actual physical miracle happen to them? I have. So if they bothered to ask, if they say miracles are not a part of this natural world, all they got to do is ask around, and it won't take too long before they find somebody. So this is a bogus argument from them to say that miracles do not occur because we don't see them in our natural, in our day-to-day experience. Well, you know what? These things don't happen in our day-to-day experience either, and you're asking us to believe them. Okay. Now I want to talk about bias. Which position, the naturalist model or the theistic model, goes in with the most assumptions? They accuse us of seeing God in everything. But even Al admitted that if you simply look at the evidence without bias, it looks designed. So our position has a lower level of bias. Their position looks like this. Evidence from nature plus there is no God equals materialism. That is the bias position, not ours. Get this in your head. That's the bias position. Not ours, because they're adding that qualifier for which they have no evidence. They're just saying he doesn't exist. And they stomp their foot. Which I forgot already.
What makes their bias?
They simply believe that there is no God, and they are putting that in there without evidence, without proof. They're just saying there is no God, and we got to figure it out. Even though it looks designed, it has all the design characteristics, we know all that, but it's not, because God doesn't exist. Which one is the most biased position?
When you come to the origin of the universe, there is overwhelming proof for the God of the Bible. And that's really the kicker on this part.
It's kind of like saying, okay, I want you to solve this equation. Okay? What's 2 plus 2? But it can't be 4. I'm excluding, before you even get to it, the answer of 4. Okay? That's what they're saying.
That's good.
So which position starts with the most assumptions? Now, which position blocks scientific inquiry? In several of the predictions that we talked about, some of we didn't get to, the naturalist answer to why is this the way it is because that's the way it is. Now, which our position is, well, it was created by a God, and let's investigate who this God is, and what exactly did he create, and what didn't he, and how did he do it, and what mechanism did he use, and can it adapt? We're keeping on going. They're hitting the wall and saying, you know what? We flipped that coin 10,000 times and it came up heads every time, but you know what? I believe it's a fair coin and that's just the way it is. So which position blocks scientific inquiry?
I mean, that goes on to what you talked about, the whole study of the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, was stifled for decades because of it.
That's right. Which position appeals more to expected future discoveries? Oh, my goodness. If you look at the evidence as it is right now, it looks designed. For you to not believe it's designed, I think you have to say, well, in the future we're going to discover this and we're going to find this self-organizing principle and the odds are really going to go down for it happening by itself. That's not how science works. You look at the logic, look at the reasons, look at the evidence as it is right now. Which one wins? Okay.
And you need no more questions. You need to conclude.
Okay. Where is the evidence headed? That's another thing to look at. I want to read this statement. This is something I wrote it, and I want to get it just right. So. Given our current state of understanding, the odds of the origin of life happening by any conscious or undirected process are so long that it is indistinguishable from a miracle. After all, what's more likely to come about by natural processes? The self-assembly of the most complex machine that we know of, the cell, or water turning into wine? The physical features of the universe being so finely tuned that they allow for the possibility of life, or that a man being lame from birth all of a sudden is able to walk. It seems then that both sides believe in miracles. The difference is that the theistic position posits a creative force whose characteristics qualify it as being God in the traditional sense. The naturalist position has no rational explanation. Now, I want to read one last thing. It's from this excellent, wonderful book. This is talking about the bias that the scientists have. This is an admission by a Harvard geneticist named Richard Lewontin. This is an introduction to Carl Sagan's book. Listen to what he says about the scientific method. You tell me how open this is. Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, Easter Bunny stories, because we have a prior commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Listen to this last sentence. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. God's Undertaker, John Lennox.
It's a preface to Carl Sagan's book.
It's a preface to Carl Sagan's book. Okay, everybody. Thank you. Let's pray, everybody. Jesus, thank you so much that we can talk about you. We can talk about you boldly with the evidence on our side, but we never forget that the main thing that brings people to know you is our love for them and your love for them and our love for each other. And I ask that we never, ever, ever forget that we have to love each other and love people who don't know you. Thank you for this class and what all these people mean to me, and bless each one of us as we go our way this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen.